VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. Thousands of mostly young Palestinian men turned out today for an annual protest organized by Hamas at the border fence between Israel and Gaza. The rally coincided with a sandstorm, which appeared to lessen the expected turnout. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Dozens of ambulances crisscrossed the area near the border fence between the Hamas-controlled territory of Gaza and Israel in anticipation of casualties from Saturday's demonstration. Arab media reported that two young men were killed and dozens were wounded by gunfire. Live video on Arab news channels showed clusters of young men hovering near the border fence as a sandstorm covered the region. Arab media reported that several thousand security forces belonging to Hamas were stationed in the area.
That was Edward Uranian reporting for VOA. Earlier today, Gaza's health ministry said a 21-year-old Palestinian man was shot dead by Israeli forces near the border fence before the demonstration began. In Afghanistan, a mortar attack on a school in the volatile southeastern Ghazni province has killed at least four students and wounded more than a dozen, including two teachers. The assault comes on the heels of the Taliban capturing a strategically important northeastern district where a dozen Afghan police and security personnel died. It is not certain who fired the mortar round, and a government official tells VOA the incident is being investigated. South Korea has announced that President Moon Jae-in will travel to Washington next month for a summit with U.S. President Donald Trump. A prime topic, the stalemated nuclear dialogue with North Korea. It will be the first meeting for the two men since Mr. Trump's second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un collapsed over the issue of U.S. sanctions. For all the day's news, we invite you to go online to voanews.com. You can also use the VOA News mobile app. This is VOA News. While Britain remains paralyzed in its promise to leave the European Union, the White House says President Trump is eager to cut a bilateral trade deal with an independent Britain. National Security Advisor John Bolton says when the British leave the European Union, the United States will be ready to do business.
People who worry about the UK crashing out of the European Union, that's the phrase they use, they're going to crash right into the United States. We're standing here waiting to make a trade deal with a United Kingdom independent of the European Union. I don't want to get into the specifics of what's been going on in the House of Commons, but I can say unequivocally that President Trump is eager for the will of the British people to be carried out, and he's even more eager to do a trade deal.
U.S. Attorney General William Barr says a redacted version of the Mueller report on the 2016 presidential election is being prepared for release to Congress. This as President Trump puts new emphasis on his insistence that the Mueller investigation was a hoax and a witch hunt. Meanwhile, the president has more harsh words for another of his favorite targets, Mexico.
I'm very upset with Mexico. I think Mexico is doing a lot of talking. They have the strongest immigration laws anywhere in the world. They probably have the strongest. And we have the worst. We have the weakest, the most pathetic, the most laughed at immigration laws anywhere in the world. They're the Democrats' laws. And I got stuck with them.
The president is once again threatening to seal the border with Mexico if it does not do more to combat illegal immigration to the United States. Aid agencies are working to prevent another cholera epidemic in war-torn Yemen. Here is Lisa Schlein for VOA in Geneva.
Children represent 27% of the total number of suspected cases. The Yemeni people and health workers are still reeling from the devastation caused by the cholera epidemic that engulfed the country over the past 2 years. The outbreak that erupted in April 2017 is the worst in recorded history. It affected more than 1.2 million people, killing more than 2,500. The World Health Organization reports 239 districts in Yemen have reported suspected cholera cases within the last 4 weeks.
The use of sewage for fertilization of crops.
That was Lisa Schlein reporting for VOA from Geneva. A Brazilian judge has blocked President Jair Bolsonaro's plans to hold a Sunday celebration to mark the 1964 coup that established a military dictatorship in Brazil. The coup overthrew the democratic government of João Goulart. Bolsonaro had ordered the military to stage a celebration. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, sitting in for Peter Clote.
Like he's going to be getting a warm reception. In fact, he's scheduled to celebrate a mass. He's also scheduled to travel to a migrant center that is run by the Catholic organization Caritas.
Pope Francis visits Morocco in a bid to build relations with the Muslim world's Muslims.
A formal ban on any journalist, not just people who work for VOA or BBC officially, but any journalist, be they Burundian or working for it or international, none of them are allowed to share any information with the BBC or VOA that could be broadcast on those radio stations.
Burundi intensifies media crackdown as BBC and VOA are banned in the country.
Kenya has international treaties it has signed. It is on laws it has passed, and therefore it has certain international obligations, which it is also violating by proceeding with what they are doing.
And the future for a 250,000 refugees in Kenya's Dadaab camp hangs in the balance as authorities are threatening once again to close the 25-year-old camp. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Pope Francis is in Morocco as part of his ongoing effort to advance interreligious dialogue. It's the first visit by a pope to the predominantly Muslim country in 34 years. Just last month, the pope visited the predominantly Muslim United Arab Emirates. Sabina Castafranco has more for VOA.
Pope John Paul II was the last head of the Catholic Church to visit Morocco in August 1985. Moroccans are seeing the current visit in a positive way, and the message that Pope Francis has for them is that Muslims and Christians can peacefully coexist. Ahead of the two-day visit, Pope Francis issued a video message for the Moroccan people. He thanked King Mohammed VI for inviting him and Moroccan authorities for their collaboration in making this visit possible.
Sulle orme del mio santo predecessore Giovanni Paolo II, vengo come pellegrino di pace.
Pope Francis said that following in the footsteps of his holy predecessor John Paul II, he is coming as a pilgrim of peace and brotherhood in a world that greatly needs it. Francis added that both Christians and Muslims believe in God, who created men and women and placed them in the world so that they might live as brothers and sisters, respecting each other's diversity and helping each other in their needs. Morocco's population is almost all Muslim, with the local Catholic community consisting of some 23,000 faithful. The majority of them are immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa. The Pope will spend only 27 hours in Morocco, but he has a busy schedule. On his first day in Rabat, the Pope focuses on interfaith dialogue and on solidarity with migrants. He will be visiting the Mohammed VI Institute for the training of imams in what is expected to be a significant moment of his visit. It is the first time a pope is welcomed in a school for imams. This is part of the Moroccan king's effort against fundamentalism while promoting a moderate approach to Islam. On Saturday, Pope Francis also will be meeting with migrants at a center run by the Catholic charity Caritas. There are some 50,000 migrants in Morocco, and about 4,000 are looked after by Caritas. The issue of migrants is an important one, as Morocco's proximity to Spain has led many migrants to travel this route to enter Europe. On Sunday, Pope Francis will visit the Center for Social Services at Tamara, just south of Rabat, which used to be a rural school run by Jesuits and is now an important care center for children. The Pope will then hold a meeting with religious men and women in Rabat Cathedral and lunch with the country's bishops. Before returning to the Vatican, Pope Francis will celebrate Mass at the city's Prince Malai Abdullah Stadium. The Mass is expected to be attended by at least half the Catholic population in the country. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The Burundian government has indefinitely blocked VOA and BBC broadcasts and outlawed journalists from providing information to the broadcasters. The government announced Friday that the British Broadcasting Corporation and the Voice of America are no longer allowed to broadcast. The ban is indefinite and extends journalists, both foreign and domestic, who provide information to either broadcaster. In a statement, VOA Director Amanda Bennett said, quote, "We are alarmed that reporters in Burundi are now forbidden to communicate with VOA and believe these continuing threats to our journalists undermine press freedom in the country." She said VOA stands with the people of Burundi against those who are restricting their access to accurate and reliable news and information. Amnesty International described the ban as brazen efforts by the Burundian authorities to silence the media. Rachel Nicholson is Amnesty International's researcher on Rwanda and Burundi. VOA's Salem Solomon Fekadu caught up with her to find out more.
What is happening right now? What triggered for the Burundian government to issue a statement to ban the BBC and the Voice of America broadcasting inside or from the country?
So in May 2018, actually just about a week before the referendum in Burundi on the new constitution, the National Communications Council suspended both the VOA and BBC for 6 months. They've been off air since then, so that's over, you know, almost a year they've been off air. And today we found out that the VOA is now going to be off air until further notice. So it's not clear how long that's going to be, and that the BBC has had its operating license definitively withdrawn. At issue were the several issues of concern for the government. For the BBC, that has been certain interviews that have been aired that they've taken issue with, and a documentary that went out late last year that the government says is full of lies. For DOA, various issues have been raised, but largely including one thing that was cited today in the government's communication was the fact that VOA employs a Burundian journalist that they accuse of involvement in the coup in 2015. And I think it's really important that we put these suspensions and now bans in the context of, you know, ongoing restrictions on independent media in Burundi. So these don't come out of the blue. Independent media stations were closed down and were actually, some of them were destroyed in May 2015, and many of them have been off air ever since throughout this political crisis that's been going on since 2015. You know, many journalists have had to flee the country. Many human rights defenders have had to flee the country. The UN Human Rights Office was closed down last month. Many independent observers have been declared persona non grata. So it's really within that context that we have to look at these closures.
Mm-hmm. And they're mentioning specific names of journalists or reporters that are Burundian when they're issuing these statements. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, they have named individuals in the statement. So particularly a Burundian journalist who worked for an independent radio station before joining VOA is one that has been named. But I think it's really important. I think it's really worrying to see the government personalize attacks on radio stations. They have such an important role to play, particularly the BBC and VOA, particularly in the absence of independent Burundian radio stations operating from within the country. The BBC and VOA have such an important role to play in sharing information with people in Burundi, both about what's happening in Burundi and getting that information out, but also making sure that there's free access to information in Burundi. One thing that's new today from the statements that came out is a formal ban on any journalist, not just people who work for VOA or BBC officially, but any journalist, be they Burundian or working for or international, none of them are allowed to share any information with the BBC or VOA that could be broadcast on those radio stations. So that's something that's quite new, and I find that a very worrying development.
Is there anything that you notice when you hear statements like this? That what is the government afraid of?
That's a very good question. We have seen over the last few years so many attempts by the government of Burundi to prevent information getting out as to the serious political crisis that has been ongoing since April 2015, when there were protests around Nkurunziza's decision to stand again for a third term in office. And there have been serious human rights violations continuing since then, but the government does not want the information about those violations to get out. And I believe that's one of the reasons why we've seen so many attempts to close down those free avenues and channels of information flow.
Is there anything that Amnesty International would recommend that, you know, the Burundian government should do if they listen?
Now, right now, we are looking at the preparations for the 2020 elections coming up next year. It's a really important moment for the government to reconsider some of these decisions. I would really, really strongly encourage the government, Amnesty International would encourage the government to reverse some of these decisions. If the situation in Burundi is improving, as the government says, then there should be no problem with allowing independent radio, independent NGOs, the United Nations and others to operate freely in the country and to attest to that fact.
That was Rachel Nicholson, Amnesty International's researcher on Rwanda and Burundi. She spoke with my colleague Salem Solomon Fekadu. With economic, political and other challenges, Zimbabwe is a stressful place to live for most of its citizens. But women living with disabilities face extra challenges. With the end of the International Women's Month, a disability lobby group has urged government and the public to shift their focus on disability issues. For VOA reporter Kuzai Vinashi has more.
Rejoice Chimire is a senator who is disabled and says disabled people are disenfranchised from basic services in society.
Now you can see the challenges which we have. If I go to the hospital, just for cervic cancer, you find the bed is too narrow. I can't. And the nurses will tell you, we can't lift you. So which means I cannot be screened for cancer, which is a killer disease. That's violating my own right as a human being.
She puts herself in the shoes of a deaf woman trying to access healthcare services.
If I go there as a deaf woman to be screened for cancer, and then I need someone, a third person, to interpret, my privacy is violated. Our dignity as women with a disability, yeah, it's compromised. I have my own privacy, so I need one-on-one with my doctor.
She adds that government institutions across the board, including the education and health sectors, do not have staff that is knowledgeable on how to communicate or assist disabled people, but that should be a requirement. Chimire says the present situation is that the disabled person needs to find an aide to accompany them to the hospital and in some cases need an interpreter. All this means the disabled individual will need to pay for such help, but the economic standing of most people with disabilities does not allow that.
How many people will afford that? As we look at women with disability and girls with disability, we are the poor of the poorest. Why? The majority of us are not educated. We are not employed. So how can we then afford all these fees?
She adds that even public school teachers don't know how to teach children with disabilities. Lillian Gwanyanya is the National Secretary for National Council of Disabled Persons of Zimbabwe. She says amendments should be made to the constitution to address the issues.
There is a lot that we go through as women with disabilities. When I look at the constitution, what it says about persons with disabilities, Section 83. There's no really commitment to issues of persons with disabilities because it leaves room for people to manipulate it, because it doesn't really enforce to say there must be something for persons with disabilities. It says if finances are available.
Agnes Chindimba is the director of Deaf Women Included, a non-profit organization that has been pushing for inclusion of disabled women in all sectors of society. She says there is stigma against people with disabilities that needs to change. Going forward, Kwanyanya says government should lead the way in including disabled women in various high-level capacities within government. An example, she says, would be including at least one disabled woman to serve on government boards and commissions. For VOA, this is Kudze Zinawashe from Harare.
The future for 250,000 refugees in Kenya's Dadaab camp has been made uncertain as authorities are threatening once again to close the 25-year-old camp on the border with Somalia. Rights groups warn the refugees face violence and drought if they are forced to return to their home countries. As Sarah Kimani reports from Nairobi for VOA.
21-year-old Nyamwach James is a South Sudanese refugee living in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp, at least for now. Nyamwach is one of the 250,000 refugees and asylum seekers living in the camp, the third largest in the world. But according to leaked United Nations documents and Kenyan media, authorities have revived threats to shut the camp down by August, citing security concerns. Nyamwach says shutting down the camp would amount to punishing thousands of innocent refugees like herself.
It's like they're grouping everyone that is on this side of the Dadaab as the bad guys. And they should consider this young generation that are benefiting from this free education in the camp and the free accommodation, the free food and the free housing.
Officials argue the camp, home mainly to Somali refugees, breeds insurgents who carry out terror attacks inside Kenya. The January Al-Shabaab militant attack on a Nairobi hotel that killed 21 people spurred the latest effort to close Dadaab. Kenyan media report some of the perpetrators were traced to the camp, but rights groups say closing the camp would not solve Kenya's security problems. Otieno Namwaya is Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch.
We asked them whether they have any people who are facing prosecutions for terrorism or terror-related offences, and we can trace them back to Dadaab camp. They did not have. And we also asked them whether there are any cases that are being investigated of people who are linked to Dadaab camp. They did not have. Up to now, they have never produced any evidence other than this blanket condemnation. So we don't think that fear is backed up by evidence.
Kenyan authorities declined requests for a comment on the leaked report and the future of the camp. The UN Refugee Agency, in a written response to the Kenyan government, says it continues to work with them for a lasting solution. The UNHCR said that includes voluntary repatriation, resettlement into third countries, or relocation to the Kakuma refugee camp on the border with South Sudan. Forcing the refugees to return to violence and drought in their home countries would be inhumane and violate Kenya's international obligations, says Namwaya.
Kenya has international treaties it has signed. It has own laws it has passed, and therefore it has certain international obligations, which it is also violating by proceeding with what they are doing.
This is not the first time the East African nation has threatened to close the Dadaab refugee camp. In 2016, Kenya's Interior Security Ministry announced it would close the camp for reasons that included the environment, economic burden, and national security. A year later, Kenya's High Court stopped those plans, ruling that closing the camp would be unconstitutional and a violation of international obligations. Commander Musheke is with Kenya's National Commission on Human Rights, which filed the case. He says the leaked documents show Kenyan authorities are intent on pushing for the camp to close.
We feel that this is a way of circumventing the court orders by exerting pressure on the UNHCR.
A voluntary repatriation process from 2014 to 2018 helped over 80,000 Somalis in the camp to return home. But refugee numbers have remained steady since, according to Kamanda, due to rising violence inside Somalia. Sarah Kemani for VOA News, Nairobi.
For the first time, a person living with HIV has donated a kidney to a transplant recipient also living with HIV. A team from Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore performed the surgery on March the 25th. VOA's Carl Pearson has more.
Up until now, people with HIV were not permitted to donate their organs, even to others living with HIV. The surgery was considered too risky for the potential donor, but treatment for HIV has changed so much since the disease was first detected in the 1980s that two doctors at Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore decided it was time to explore that possibility. In the first ever HIV to HIV kidney transplant, Dr. Dori Segev, the surgeon, spoke to VOA by Skype. Segev said the procedure was more than a kidney transplant.
This week, we celebrate the first time that somebody living with HIV became a living kidney donor, was able to donate a kidney to somebody else to save somebody else's life. And it's sort of a celebration that HIV has transitioned from a disease that 30 years ago was basically a death sentence to today, a condition that is so well controlled with modern medication that somebody with HIV can actually save somebody else's life by donating a kidney.
People with well-controlled HIV can live a healthy life and have a normal lifespan. Dr. Dori Segev fully evaluated the donor before allowing her to undergo the procedure.
Nina Martinez, who was the person who donated the kidney, is exceptionally healthy with meticulous care of her HIV and completely well-controlled HIV and no risk of heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, the kind of things that would rule somebody out from donating. The recipient is somebody with HIV who has end-stage kidney disease and needs a transplant.
The surgery took place on March 25th. Segev says the donor and the recipient are doing well. Segev says what's most important is that this surgery increases the number of potential kidney donors and the number of people whose lives can be saved.
Nina's groundbreaking donation and interest in becoming the first living kidney donor with HIV in the entire world now opens a door for everybody to do this.
Right now, it's only legal to do HIV to HIV transplantation. But Dr. Christina Durand, who works with Segev, says one day people living with HIV might be able to donate organs to those without the disease. Durand also spoke by Skype.
If I needed an organ transplant and there was a potential HIV-positive donor and it meant I needed to take an HIV medication for the rest of my life, I'd probably take that organ.
Both doctors say this surgery will help change the image of HIV and hopefully reduce the stigma associated with being positive. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. And now it's time for a Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa.
Some Uber taxi to Range Rover, oh, the boy don't hammer, oh. Ya no sorum ke leji hova, oh, mene me kwa la yosa, oh. My landlord is now no my tenant, you know be man power, no, 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 no. China, UK, Malaysia, Jehovah, Bawo Mogaranya, oh. From Uber taxi to Range Rover, oh, the boy don't hammer, oh. My landlord is now my tenant, you know be man power, no, no, no.
China, UK, Malaysia, Jehovah, Bawo Mogara. Last Christmas, Imanazo Friji Kanji Shetu. This Christmas, Ngi Wifi Naba, wonderful goodness. For God, Thanksgiving, for the life that I'm living. Napuni Malomono, you should know where I'm living. Taking on my believing, Ganda Musi Chajin, and Ali Jemu Gobu movie. Gotta, gotta keep it moving. And Manko Chang Woody, the type of joy that I'm feeling. And you praise God for singing, praise God. From Uber taxi to Range Rover, oh, the boy don't have a home. China, UK, Malaysia, Jehovah, Bawo Mogara.
Put it down. She make me wanna ding, ding, dong. Every day she a calling up my phone, say she wants some good, good love. Hey. As soon as hook her back, ding, ding, dong. She say she wanna good, good loving, so me give her some good, good love. Thank hey. You. I'm the girl, them number one. Me a the girl, them champion. Yeah. All the ladies love to wine. Anytime I come, they put it down.
Do you want baby?
Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Salim, producer Saida Hamdun, we thank you for joining us tonight and join us tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpuga.